Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here too. Hello, Lucy, and welcome back to this, our first episode of 2021.
Hello.
What's new with you?
Happy New Year, if that's still appropriate.
I think you can say until the end of this week, after which there's no talk of happiness or New
Year's. The happiness is wishful thinking, put it that way.
What's new then? Did you catch up on all of the reading that you presumably hope to do over the Christmas break?
Not all of it. I'm now too into the Elizabeth Jane Howard, the Cazalet Chronicles that you pressed on me. And I only haven't got the others because I can't get them. They're out of stock from where I'm trying to
really?
Buy them from. Yeah. I think there must have been a run. I think probably because of this podcast.
It's highly likely.
Completely sold out. So you're welcome, Elizabeth Jane Howard's
I'll estate. Be taking my commission.
Yeah, good. But so I need to get the third one because I raced through the second one.
I think I can send you the third one.
Oh, that would be brilliant.
We can sort that out off this podcast.
I don't want everyone
to think I can send the third one.
And I tried to do a bit of, I'm trying to read up a bit, trying to give myself a bit more science, which I sorely neglected in the times when I was supposed to be studying science. And I also read Three Men in a Boat. For fun.
Oh, did you?
Because I never read it before and I wanted something.
Had you
fun.
Not?
No.
It's isn't it the one of the most common favourite books of all time?
I think so, probably. Yeah. And you know, lots of it is jolly good. The dog is really good because he seems completely angelic and he's just awful. And the way he talks about him is brilliant.
My granddad has Alzheimer's and the only book that he remembers is that book. So you can talk to him about Jerome K. Jerome, about that book specifically, that and a biography of an Everton football player. Those are the only two books that he remembers. So we find ourselves just going from one to the other.
That gives you a lot of material, though. A lot of excellent material. Well, and it's good as well because it's so geographically specific. That must be partly why it's lasted. I mean, also because a lot of it is delightful. You know, you can still go down that stretch of river in a boat, and I bet quite a lot of it looks the same. Though you might manage it better than those three, or maybe more.
Well, we're trying not to encourage my granddad to go down the river in a boat.
No, I don't think I don't think that.
Certainly not now,
especially not at the moment. No.
Well, this week it is not a Jerome K. Jerome special, alas. Coming up on this week's show. When it comes to the business of republishing neglected books, there is a balancing act involved in finding something that both illuminates the historical moment in which it was forged and speaks to readers today. So writes Lucy Scholes, reviewing a clutch of books, some of which pull off that balance, from the British Library's Women's Writers series, which sells itself as a curated collection of novels by female authors who enjoyed broad popular appeal in their day, but which have since been lost in the mist of time. And whether or not we'll be talking about them in a century's time, we'll take a quick look at some of the books set to be published in 2021. But first, to Pakistan, where, when it comes to the writing of Western correspondents, it can be difficult to move for cliché. I have read enough books by foreign correspondents to Pakistan to recognise common tropes, writes the Karachi-based journalist Sana Maya in this week's TLS. The story usually starts with disappointment at having been posted there at all, after which the narrative tends to become locked in a tragic mode. Who or what does this serve? Who in these stories counts as a source? Is there perhaps another way? Sana Maya tackles these questions among many others and joins us on the line from Karachi now to tell us more. Hello, Sana.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The occasion for this wonderful piece of yours lies in the arrival of a book by a foreign correspondent, The Nine Lives of Pakistan by Declan Walsh. And we'll go into that. But first, you say you were wary when this book first came through your letterbox. Can you give us a sense of what exactly you dreaded finding between its covers?
I think it wasn't dread so much as weariness. I've read enough books by foreign correspondents to sort of notice that there tends to be a pattern, there tends to be a certain story that, you know, once you've heard it a couple of times, hearing it again and again can be a little dull. I think that when it comes to Pakistan and events over here, people over here, when you start hearing the same story over and over again about the place that you're from, the experiences that you're having, the people around you, it can tend to get a bit dull. It can be frustrating to hear the same thing, the same mistakes, the same cliches. And so I was a little bit, you know, wary of that. I didn't really want to sort of commit to reading another book that was about the same thing.
The same thing being what exactly?
I mean, if we just consider an average reader, what the average reader might know about Pakistan just from, say, the headlines or from the newspapers or from the nightly news. The story that you're told is about a country that is very, very poor, that is very chaotic, that is very violent. It's dangerous to be in. I think some of the headlines that we've had, particularly after 9/11, you know, really sum it up. I think Newsweek was the one that very famously called us the most dangerous nation in the world. And that's kind of been our introduction, really. That's the story that's told over and over again. And sometimes I don't want to read another piece that's told through that lens. And I did wonder if this book would sort of take on more of that, as I've seen with other books, or because of how long Declan Walsh actually spent here in Pakistan, 9 years, which is much longer than foreign correspondents tend to spend over here. I did wonder if it was going to be any different.
Well, actually, Walsh's book does start off with an image that is quite striking in a sense and quite poignant and self-reflexive, it seems. He's in a hotel room, he's cut off from the country, and he's quite painfully aware of that fact.
So this is in 2013, on the night of the elections over here. A period of military rule had ended, a democratic government was there and handing over power to another democratic government, which was a first for us. We've sort of had these bouts of democratic governments, military rule, government being toppled, coups happening. So this was a big moment where it was one democratic government handing over to another. And the book opens with him in a hotel room, laying on his bed, staring at the ceiling. And he can hear outside his window, like all of the sounds of celebration and, you know, just men out on the streets after they've voted and they're getting the results in. And he's getting these updates on his phone. And he's in there with two intelligence officers posted at his hotel room door. He's unable to leave because he's been told his visa has been revoked. He's done something to annoy the authorities and he's been asked to leave immediately and not given any explanation. He's not allowed to go out and report on the elections. And he's essentially only got one place to be, that's on the way out.
So when we first encounter Declan Walsh, he's sort of at the end of a line, isn't he? There's a kind of contract that we can expect between a foreign correspondent and the host country. And at the point at which this book starts for Declan Walsh, that contract has been broken. He's out. The journey is in a way over, but really here it's just the beginning.
Well, the journey is over, but in a very abrupt way. And I think what he sets up is essentially this riddle that he wants to solve. After 9 years of reporting extensively on Pakistan, covering anything that may have happened in the country, going across the country, different provinces, covering human rights abuses, looking at sort of every story possible, what is it that he could have finally done that was the last straw? And so he sets up a question for himself. He wants to find out what it is that he's done. He wants to solve the mystery of where did he push the envelope too far? What line did he cross? And it's an interesting one because, I mean, he starts to look at, you know, what secret did I finally unravel? What story did I tell that really wasn't supposed to be told? And that's kind of that takes us into his 9 years in the country and the answers that he finally arrives at about why he was asked to leave.
He does seem to have a different approach, though, as you say, possibly partly because he stayed there longer than a number of the other books that you mention of the correspondents that come to Pakistan. There's one quote I was struck by when you quote Christina Lamb, who says, "Pakistan is a magical land inhabited by nonsense names like the Wali of Swat, the Mir of Hunza, and the Jam of Lasbela. But these are only nonsense names if you don't speak that language.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, I think it takes us some time to figure out some, like, I didn't know Worcester was pronounced the way that it was until I think somebody told me.
Exactly. So, how could you? So that's a nonsense name.
Like, I had a sense when I started reading Declan's book that I was a bit tired of reading the same story about Pakistan over and over. But that was a sense I had, and I really wanted to back it up. And what I ended up doing was going through every book that I had that had been written by a foreign correspondent about Pakistan, and then going into newspaper archives all the way back to partition, which is 1947, and just seeing what are some of the common ways in which this place is talked about even today. And so something like that quote that you mentioned with Christina Lamb, it was really surprising to me to read that from the 80s, but then you'll see that same sentiment in a book that came out in the 2000s. Like if we look at Kim Barker's book, for instance, where she really sort of lays into the country and talks about it's such a schizophrenic place and nothing here makes sense. And what are these nonsense names? So as much as I'd like to say that, yeah, that's such an outdated idea, we don't talk in those ways anymore, it's not okay anymore, I don't think that's the case. And that is what surprised me.
And it's true. You quote Emma Duncan of The Economist, and she writes, why do they pretend to be in 20th century Europe when they're in 7th century Asia? I think she uses the word duped. She says that the visitor is duped. And I think that word, it sort of brings something that's adversarial into the relationship, but also it's something as though it seems almost to imply that something is owed to the person who is visiting, something is owed to the correspondence. There's a certain self-centeredness, and I don't know if entitlement is the right word, but as though they should have everything, they should be able to, again, I think I'm overstating this perhaps, but they should be able to solve the riddle, to win it.
I agree. And I think what comes across really over there is this frustration that you've landed in this place that you never really wanted to be sent to. A lot of these books start in that way as well, where the foreign correspondent, you know, wants to go to a place like India, Sri Lanka, or even Iran, but doesn't manage to somehow get the gig or a visa falls through, and they land in Pakistan. And it's almost like second best. They're annoyed to be there, but then they start to see, okay, maybe there's a certain story I could tell about this place. And then there's frustration that the place doesn't yield to that demand, that it isn't as easy to unravel, that certain things are, if you arrive there with a set of expectations, it is going to confound those. So when we look at that Emma Duncan story, she was talking about being in, I believe it was in Lahore, and being in these sort of hanging out with these really wealthy Pakistanis and their beautiful homes, and the way that they talk, the things that they talk about, the books, the films, the plays. She feels like she's almost in London. And then when she hears them talking about arranged marriages for their children, she can't quite understand how that dissonance, it doesn't really make sense to her.
And it's one of the points when Declan Walsh writes about secrets and sort of says that a country is sort of the sum of the secrets that it wishes to keep, is one of his points that the keeping of these secrets has in a way been aided by foreign correspondents who maybe haven't been making the most of the freedoms and the safety that they alone are granted.
I wouldn't say that they aid that. I do think that if you are working here as a journalist, it is a very tricky place to work in. And times when journalists have crossed a line, they have been taken to task for it. Declan, for instance, his visa being canceled, him being sort of unceremoniously asked to leave. I think that he doesn't put across this idea that foreign correspondents aid that. And I wouldn't say that they do. I think that the secrets that they have tried to uncover, there's a vulnerability there. There's a fear there. Why is it that you keep a secret? You're nervous about it being found out because it reveals where you're most vulnerable. And I think that local and foreign journalists really have to figure out a way in which to do their work, to follow the most interesting stories. But also, yes, they do find out certain things where for their own safety or for the safety of the people who work with them, they may not share those stories. I wouldn't go so far as to say that they aid the hiding of certain secrets. There's just no way to talk about them, maybe.
Yeah, I suppose the difference being, you when you write about the the treatment of Declan Walsh, for example, the kind of the support system that he has behind him, it suggests that it's more possible for him to, as you say, because the outlets are there, I suppose, he's able to write about things and not be punished in the most grave degree compared to someone, a local journalist, for example. You give the case of Hamir Mir, or Walsh gives the case of Hamir Mir, who is dealt with very, very differently. So I suppose my point is, one, a foreign correspondent is able to get away with pushing further than a local journalist, perhaps. And the line is, and it is differently positioned, say.
Absolutely. And I think that there is a greater safety net that the foreign correspondent has. When you have an organization that is going to back you up, that is going to pursue a case if you're treated a certain way, versus with local media organizations where maybe they don't have the clout, they can't do something like that. Declan's case, for instance, was chased up by his editors who went on to meet the prime minister when he was visiting New York for a UN summit. A local journalist can't dream of that sort of thing. And we're not just talking about instances where it's a national security thing. Like you mentioned Hamid Mir, this is a situation where a man who had a very, very popular talk show went on to cross a line when it came to the army. And he was in his car, he was shot at, he was very badly injured. And his media organization could not stand up for him, could not do anything in that instance. The army turned around and demanded that the channel should be shut down. What do you do in the face of that kind of pressure? But as I said, it's not just when it comes to national security or reporting on the army or political parties. If I consider as a freelancer working in Pakistan, sometimes I cannot follow up on a story because the organization that I'm working for is unable to take on the risk of a certain story. Like they aren't here in the country. I'm a freelancer. I'm not even a full-time employee of theirs. If something does go sideways, I bear the brunt of that. I can't expect them to step up in that instance. So you're always kind of working in a bit of a gray zone as compared to a foreign correspondent who has a much greater degree of security and can sometimes also just, like, very simply can leave if needed.
I mean, in a way, I think if you say when Declan Walsh is uncovering, as you say, all sorts of stories in Pakistan, not just the things that are always covered. And I get the impression that you think this book has more worth than a lot of them because he's being very thorough about it and he is genuinely trying to understand. He's not trying to put his interpretation on. He's genuinely trying to understand how things work and using that position of privilege.
I think the books that that work really well when they're telling a story from Pakistan is when you can clearly see that the reporter has taken the time to really get to know the place and hasn't tried to position themselves as a translator for the place or sort of presenting this place as this mysterious, very unknowable space where crazy things happen and they're going to explain it all to you and sort of unravel the mystery of this crazy place that makes no sense to a Western audience. Books like Declan's, for instance, you can really tell that he spent the 9 years here. He has really tried to get at a different story. He's tried to present also the way he tells it and sort of the ending that he arrives at, the small details that he notices. That was all very different for me. I hadn't noticed that before with many of the books.
And there are some excellent stories and characters, aren't there? You talk about a vigilante who kind of sets the world straight with God and his gun. And can you give us a sense of kind of the range of characters, the cast and the stories that we do get in the book?
Yeah, so it's like the book's title, I mean, Nine Lives of Pakistan. He singles out nine particularly interesting characters from his years reporting here. And he does look at this top cop who, you know, the way that he sets about trying to find people in Karachi or the ways in which he functions within the police system. You have a woman who was one of the biggest sort of human rights activists that we had, a lawyer. She's placed under house arrest, but then she sort of gets very chummy with the police that are stationed outside her house. She gets involved in their little dramas. The thing I really liked about the book, though, is the way that he gets these small details in For instance, when he talks about one of the hotels in Islamabad and the waiter is serving wine surreptitiously, you know, in these teapots, and they'll come up to you and they have a certain way of asking you, like, if you want to have a drink, because it's illegal here. Or he'll look at something as simple as how people drive here, how there does not, it's a very organized chaos, a very organized chaotic way, but it seems to work somehow. And he uses these stories as a way to sort of build this character, and gets a lot of detail in, which I love.
I love the story of a visit to an Indian diplomat's home where she reveals that her electricity has been cut off by spiteful spooks, you say. And she says, don't worry, we do the same to their people in New Delhi. And so you get this story of basically a tit-for-tat harassment between India and Pakistan, which seems to play out in midnight ringings of each other's doorbells and then running away.
Oh yeah, ring the bell and run away just to annoy them. And it's those kinds of things that make, like, that's the stuff that stands out. You'll hear you'll read 10 stories about how India and Pakistan are always at each other's throats. And then you'll read a detail like that, like people going up to each other's homes and ringing the bell at 3 a.m. and running off. That'll stand out in your mind.
It also makes it much, less, you know, there's that sort of tendency to dramatize it and say, this is the end times and there's this terrible clash between, and in fact, when it turns out that people, it's also people ringing each other's doorbells just to annoy each other, it makes it much more human and less sort of global, and it lowers the stakes, I would say, rather than raising them.
It also gives you this very, it paints such an interesting picture, doesn't it, of this place that I think the richness here is the craziness. There's this great line in Declan's book where a friend says, we don't have magical realism, we just have realism. Like, you actually cannot make them up. It's stranger than fiction. And I think he really revels in that. And he understands that he's got a great set of characters. He's got great stories that he's amassed in 9 years. He doesn't need to pad it out. He doesn't need to add that editorializing. If he just tells the story truthfully, it's going to be pretty interesting. And he sort of keeps it very simple and economical, which I appreciate.
And crucially, he doesn't feel the need to round it up, to tie it all up with a nice, neat conclusion or projection even, does he? He leaves it supremely open-ended.
Yeah, he doesn't end with the doom and gloom of, I think the question that a lot of these books I've seen that they end with is, will Pakistan survive? Is Pakistan built to survive? Is it coming apart at the seams? What can be done for this place? And he turns around and he poses a really interesting question that this is a youthful nation, not just in terms of how long we've been around, but the fact that we have a very young population. We have more young people than old people here, and that's only going to continue. And he asks, you know, what are the ideas that are guiding these young people? What kind of lives do they envision for themselves? What kind of identity are they forming as Pakistanis? And I think it's a great sort of question that he puts out there. And he looks at all the things that Pakistan does, that it has going for it, but also all the challenges that it faces. And so he leaves it really open-ended as to which way it could go.
Well, Sanam, it's nice to be able to look at the foreign journalism of the past and also very recent past, as you say, and then work our way towards something that sounds altogether more worthwhile. Sanam, thanks very much for talking to us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Still to come on the show, books to keep you going through 2021, including hotly anticipated lives of writers including D.H. Lawrence, Philip Roth and Barbara Pym, and we'll be talking to Lucy Scholes about the British Library's revisionist publishing series, Women Writers.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast with Lucy Dallas and me, Thea Linarduzzi. Last month, we delivered a slightly chaotic and certainly idiosyncratic roundup of some of the books we, editors and our contributors, had most enjoyed in 2020. That's presumably still up on the website, is it, Lucy? As I say this, I have doubts, but it is there for anyone who wants to catch up, isn't it?
It is there, yep. It's all, if you want to have a lovely look back and bask in the wonders of 2020, or more specifically, yes, the books that people found interesting in 2020, yes, it's still there on the website.
Okay, but now though, we're going to turn bleary-eyed, certainly in my case, to what we have to look forward to. I'm trying to sound really upbeat here, to what we have to look forward to in the new year. We're going to try and cover the whole year's worth in about 5 minutes. Are you feeling generally excited about this, Lucy? Not about our coverage.
I thought you meant about our little chat. I mean, you know, yeah, sure. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff coming up.
Well, it's a big year for novels this year coming. Katsuo Ishiguro has his first one since winning the Nobel, I think. That's called Clara and the Sun. Edwin St. Aubyn of the Patrick Melrose books has a new one coming. I'm looking forward to Francis Spufford's new novel. It's called Light Perpetual. Have you read either of his previous novels? I think there's just two, Golden Hill and Red Plenty.
I haven't, I'm afraid, no.
So he's so good. I really, really recommend him. So Light Perpetual is the new one, and that's about children killed in the Blitz and what they might have gone on to do had they not died. But he has such a wonderful way of breathing life into the history, loads of life, so that the books are really bursting with it. And he's really drawn to highly specific moments of history, kind of cusp moments. So Golden Hill was set in New York in the mid-1700s. Red Plenty was a USSR at the height of the Cold War. So again, you know, during the Blitz, it's this, you know, you're on the thread between life and death. And so, yes, in short, very much looking forward to that. But then there's Viet Thanh Nguyen has a sequel to The Sympathizer, which came out a few years ago. I think it won the Pulitzer. It's about his troubled spy protagonist goes to Paris. It's the 1980s and he's in Paris in the old underworld. But there's a whole list of others. John McGregor, Richard Powers, Colson Whitehead, Laurent Binet, Lucy, one of your favourites.
I do. I am a big fan of Laurent Binet. And this is a translation of his book, Civilizations, which is a sort of counterfactual, a huge historical counterfactual. So that's coming out in translation. And actually, there's lots of wonderful literature in translation as well, of course. There's There's millions of them. There's a new Haruki Murakami, there will be. And there's a really exciting one. Woli Soyinka, this is not translated, it's just exciting, is going to produce his first novel, I think, for 50 years, called Chronicles from the Land of the Happiest People on Earth. So that'd be exciting, wouldn't it?
Do we know how long it's been in the making? Not the full 50 years. Maybe.
I don't know. I think he wrote it quite recently. I think possibly even in lockdown. There seems to be a Zadie Smith is bringing something out called The Wife of Willesden, which is a sort of version of The Wife of Bath. So that sounds fun.
Oh, that does sound fun.
And also, I think the last book in the Mallory Blackman, I forgot the name of it, Knots and Crosses.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
It's the last book in that series is coming out as well.
There's a few things that have popped up that are sort of on the French side. I know our fiction editor, David Horspool, has his eye on Colin Jones. He's written a study called The Fall of Robespierre. And there's also Ruth Sker, who also wrote A Life of Robespierre, actually,
a while back,
has a book about Napoleon coming out. And that's been in the pipeline for a while. That's out in May, which is 100th anniversary of Napoleon's death, of course. But she's taking a characteristically creative approach to the life. Have you seen this? Its subtitle is Life in Gardens and Shadows. So it grounds his revolutionary life in the quieter context of his love of nature. It sounds very you, Lucy.
It just sounds brilliant. As soon as you said
it. It sounds wonderful.
And because, of course, Josephine was very, very big in the development of roses, of course. Let's talk about that for 45 minutes.
Well, we could do. Also, because it seems this is a theme, because later in the year, Rebecca Solnit is going to do something similar, it sounds like, with the life of George Orwell. It's called Orwell's Roses, and it focuses on his life through gardening, through his love of gardening.
Brilliant. I mean, why don't all books do that? Really?
I wonder. Well, maybe this is the new thing.
There's also a nice sounding one, which I thought you might like. Taste, My Life Through Food by Stanley Tucci, the actor, who everybody just likes and appears to be a really good cook.
Yes. Oh, that incredible film whose name's completely fallen out of my head. Can I just quickly look it up rather than
Is it Big Night?
Yes. Big Night.
Yeah, that's a lovely
so
film.
So good. I watched it recently and it's just fantastic. Very dodgy accents. Not so much Stanley Tucci's, but the other accents were a little bit dodgy, but I'll let them off. It was a very good film. So I think we would probably be best to move on. If that hasn't made listeners feel more optimistic about 2021, I'm afraid this is not the podcast for you. We can't help you.
It's notoriously difficult to predict which books will strike a chord with readers, even in the year they're published, and even harder to say which ones will stick in the public mind. Longevity is a slippery beast. This week, we're looking at some of the women writers celebrated and remembered by the British Library in their series launched last year to coincide with the exhibition Unfinished Business, The Fight for Women's Rights. Our expert guide here is Lucy Scholes, who writes a monthly column for the Paris Review about out-of-print and forgotten books. She's written about some of these British Library reissues for us, and she joins us now to talk them through. Lucy, welcome back to the podcast, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too. It's nice to be here again.
Well, here we all are again in our, not in the studio, in our individual our individual booths, but there we go. You must spend a lot of time in your normal working life thinking about forgotten writers. I was wondering if you have kind of detected any particular trends or genres that are neglected more than others.
Well, that's an interesting question. The thing is, I think in recent years it's become looking for these neglected classics, these sort of forgotten gems, has become quite sort of big business, let's say. There's always been kind of good lists around, Penguin classics list, the Virago modern classics, and these in themselves have almost become classics of the genre, I suppose. And actually, but in more recent years, it seems like other publishers are starting to get in on the act and try and find their own gems from the past that people have forgotten about. And I think in doing so, they are trying to find the less expected titles, let's say. I don't know if it's a particular genre of things that is sort of being discovered, but I think what people want to find now is not the sort of forgotten work by a writer who we might recognize their name. It's like somebody completely new who's been neglected for a sort of reason that they were writing outside of their genre or outside of their age at the time. I don't know if that sort of answers your question in a roundabout way.
And I suppose inevitably a lot of these rediscovered writers and women, just because a lot of women writers were basically kind of ignored, or writers of colour, or, you know, from different cultures, or, I mean, that the kind of sociological reasons why they were neglected.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the British Library series that we're going to talk about a bit more detail, that's, you know, and a good example of that, that these are women writers who were, some of them were very popular in their day, but readers today just might not be aware of them because they've sort of sunk out of print over the years. But yes, you know, writers of colour, you know, again, that's a kind of another area that people are trying to kind of bring back, people who we might have forgotten. I mean, it's harder to find, some of the sort of things you want to find are harder to find because they weren't published in the first place. So there's a sort of tricky, you know, line to kind of you know, walk along, that, you know, you want to find these books that you think were missed at the time because somebody didn't recognize their brilliance, but actually there is, you know, some things that you think should have been published just never made it to be published in the first place.
And as you say, for this British Library series, these were not, you know, unpublished people. Some of them were actually quite successful in their own time, weren't they? What sort of writers were they?
Yeah, some of them were particularly successful. There are people here who I really wasn't that aware of, but somebody called Mary Essex, who was, I think this is just one of the many pseudonyms that she used. I think her real name was Ursula Bloom, and she published sort of over 500 novels and biographies in the course of her life, and lots of short stories and newspaper columns. So that's a huge amount of work to now be sort of pretty much forgotten by most people today.
And one of the things that's interesting about the British Library series is its criteria, or its explanation of itself, includes the word middlebrow. These are middlebrow writers. Would these writers have been defined as such at the time? Because, I mean, the term was coined in the 20s, I think, by Punch, and it was already being kind of tussled over at the time. Some people thought it was, used it as a criticism, Virginia Woolf famously, and J.B. Priestley and others thought it was something to be praised. I mean, how do you think these readers would have felt about the label if it was applied to them at the time?
I mean, I think there's obviously an ongoing discussion that we have, I think probably ever since the term middlebrow has first been used, this idea of high literature versus something that's more middlebrow, possibly more readable, some might say, possibly, you know, the novels are more accessible than some of the, particularly the sort of more high modernist, you know, literature is being written. I don't know. I mean, there's been great attempt in more recent years to really rescue these types of novels. I mean, someone like Nicola Bowman at Persephone is doing great work in bringing back a lot of forgotten writers, many of whom were termed middlebrow. I mean, she even wrote a book about the woman's middlebrow novel, talking about how popular it was, how important these books were. But there is still, you know, we still argue today about the problem of women writing novels that are set mostly in the domestic environment, and then people accusing those women of being kind of narrow-minded and writing about the small scale things in life and not the big wider world, and then men do it and it's considered to be something much more important. So I think middlebrow, it depends. For some people today, some readers today, you know, this is a sort of badge of honour that people love to find. You know, I think particularly the British Library series will find a lot of wonderful, you know, rapturous kind of audience with people who love the Persephone books, some of the Virago Modern Classics list. I think their list does a sort of twofold thing. There are writers who might fall into the middlebrow side of things, but they also publish a lot of really interesting and quite innovative writers. So there's going to be a big audience out there for these kind of books, and people, you know, some people really love it. And it's not necessarily a, you know, I think it depends where you stand on it. I don't think it's a particularly demeaning thing to be called, but then I do enjoy reading these books.
I think those labels all really annoy me. Actually, I find them fantastically unhelpful, because they're either used to punch up or punch down. And really, it just means that a lot of people enjoyed reading the book. Well, then Hilary Mantel is middlebrow, and so is Shakespeare, and so is Ulysses. A lot of people have enjoyed Ulysses. Actually, that you probably can't make that case. I mean, at that point. But I just think it's rubbish. It just means something that a lot of people enjoyed, which is.
But that's exactly the criticism. You know, if you were a high modernist, so say you're Virginia Woolf, who did take issue with it, who did use it as a criticism. Her point was precisely that, you know, the middlebrow people, people who enjoyed middlebrow books, were sort of compromised and you know, not devoted to the highest of artistic pursuit and you know, all that sort of stuff. I'm not at all agreeing with that. I'm just wondering, I suppose, at the fact of it, of its being reclaimed, and as you said, Lucy S, not Lucy D, being reclaimed and worn as a badge of honour. I just think it's an interesting thing.
Yeah, I think there is something about that, that it definitely is a, you know, I think even when I sort of tweeted something about, you know, reading some of these books, and there are certain people who follow me who are big fans of that sort of middlebrow fiction, and, you know, were keen to know what they were like, they wanted to read them. You know, there are a load of people who like that, and that's not, I don't think it's, you know, it's not better, it's not worse. It's, you know, you just, people, not, they like what they know what they like. And for some, it can be a useful, it's sort of almost gone so far that it's now a bit of a useful terminology to use, perhaps, even though obviously, it, you know, at the end of the day, it's still often yet to be punching down at them, which is unfair.
I mean, you said then, to go back on your point about the, you know, about women writing about the family life. I mean, that's absolutely, of course, that's absolutely still the case, that people make those sort of accusations, if you like. And you say it's a central concern in many of these novels, but that doesn't mean even though there's nothing wrong with a small domestic setting. I mean, as people often say, that's what Jane Austen did. But here there are big forces of history and politics and societal pressure being brought to bear on people, aren't there?
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think that's what sometimes people forget about these sorts of novels. Just because, you know, you set a novel in a domestic environment doesn't mean that you can't also be talking about the wider world and history around it. And I think some of them, you know, the ones that really stood out for me from this list as well were the ones that did both that. In particular, there's the May Sinclair's The Tree of Heaven, which is set begins before the First World War, and then you follow the protagonist through the war, and it was published in 1917, so that's, you know, while the war is still happening. And what you see is an ordinary middle class family who have got three sons and a daughter, and you see them having to sort of go about their day-to-day lives of, you know, just the regular stuff, but also contending with these great forces of history. The daughter gets involved in the women's suffrage movement, and the three men find themselves, you know, off in the trenches. And despite the sort of pulls of what their sort of individual identities, you know, demand of them, or what they think is right or wrong. And Sinclair does that beautifully. She shows how, you know, and I think she gets the point that, or I definitely came away from that novel feeling like I had sort of understood a bit more about what it would have been like to be alive at that point, and how the great disaster that was, you know, the great sort of tragedy of the loss of the First World War being such a large communal loss. But Sinclair focused it through this one individual family.
Which is what, you know, the great Russians did. I mean, and nobody says, oh, it's just domestic. I mean, that's a way of doing it. There's another one that you mention, Father by Elizabeth von Arnim, which I'm going to talk about because I've read it. So I'm just showing off to say that I know what happens in that one.
Perfect. Let's talk about it.
Well, it's one of the more lighthearted ones, as you say, and it does start off quite jolly, and it's very funny in some parts, but even so, the situations and the plight of the characters, they're very serious and really heartbreaking. And in some ways, it seemed to me that it's a book about loss and waste of human potential and happiness. Do you think they're generally small F feminist books, would you say?
That's a tricky question. I mean, whether the writers would have identified as feminist at the time, whether they would identify as something as feminist in the way that we understand feminism today, you know, these are complicated things. I think something like Father is an interesting one. It was one of the ones I was less taken with, I have to admit. But like you say, it did bring up a lot of very interesting sort of issues from the day, particularly this idea of the surplus woman, I suppose, the women who were left over after the First World War, who didn't find husbands. And then what did they do with themselves when they, as the protagonist of this book finds, that she's sort of no longer necessary in her father's life, or she sort of is in one way, but not another. He's marrying again and she wants a life of her own. So it sort of chimes with things like Virginia Woolf's essay, you know, A Room of One's Own. It chimes with something like Lolly Willows by Sylvia Townsend Warner, which is also about a woman who wants a life of her own, existence of her own outside of her family. So these were clearly important issues of the day that women were grappling with. I honestly don't know enough, particularly about Elizabeth von Arnim's own thoughts on feminism, to be able to comment any further, I think, though.
I suppose I don't mean, you know, were they card-carrying feminists, but it seems to me that in the book, what's happening is that because women don't have any agency, then there is a huge sense of loss and frustration. And of course, as is always the way, this impacts very badly on the men as well. No, I mean, it doesn't help anyone, that situation. And the book seems to be a laying out of saying this situation is a waste.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, the protagonist is sort of, you know, helpless. There are lots of funny bits, and she does sort of manage to make her way in the world outside of her father's home. But you're right, it's not easy, and she is a sort of stifled life, let's say, put it that way. You know, she's trying to grasp this freedom while she can. And I think this comes through in quite a few of the books as well. You know, there's even in The Tree of Heaven, there's a sense of, you know, the women being stuck behind while the men are off at war, which is not necessarily a great thing for the men, obviously, either. And even in a later one, which, you know, another of my favourites, I think, from the series, Chatterton Square by E.H. Young. Again, it's the sort of, you know, ostensibly a portrait of a family. This is in the run up to the Second World War, and the sort of goings on, the day to day comings and goings of these two families who live close to each other. But underneath it, you find these stories of two women whose lives have been very affected by the limitations on them. Well, three women, I should say. There are two central wives and mothers, one of whom is in a very unhappy relationship. Her husband is a sort of pompous arse, basically. And her, though Young puts it much more eloquently than me. And the other one is a woman who's separated from her husband, which is a great scandal, obviously. And then you have her friend, a spinster, like the character in Father, who is completely dependent on this friend of hers for offering her a home. I mean, these sorts of issues are, you know, clearly important. You don't need to be drumming it into our heads that this is what these books are about to realise that the plight of women at this time was, you know, quite a precarious one.
I think the blurb to that book makes the point that Chatterton Square was published 10 years after a change in divorce law, calls for a change in divorce law resulted in the Matrimonial Causes Act of 37. So you can sort of see how those three, the options or lack of options that you laid out there of these three women, that was it. That was your choice. Which one is it going to be? Marriage, unhappy marriage, spinsterhood? Yeah, I mean, it was incredibly limited. I also love the brilliantly named Mrs. Spanner. Mrs. Spanner the spinster.
Miss Spanner the spinster, presumably.
Yeah. Sorry, Miss Spanner. Yes, I would think
even,
so. Sorry.
Even better. And in terms of the evolution of the novel, I mean, maybe we answered this earlier by saying they were Middlebrow. Is there any formal experimentation? Is there any of that kind of thing or not really?
I mean, certainly not in the way that you'd be thinking of what sort of formal experimentation at that stage in, you know, in the sort of high literary fiction would be. So they don't really challenge their readers in that sense. But I don't know if that's a bad thing or a good thing, really, or maybe, you know, it's just the way it is.
So some of them were very successful, that we've established this, and I've got reprints in, you know, and people are aware of them. But who is there? Who would you recommend that we have definitely never heard of, but we should read, do you think?
Well, the one that really stood out for me on that was one called Oh, the Brave Music by Dorothy Evelyn Smith, which I really wasn't sure about when I sort of first started reading it. It's a coming of age novel and it's set just before the First World War. The main character is a young woman called Ruan Ashley, and she's looking back on her life as a child. And she grows up in sort of Yorkshire. Her father is a nonconformist minister. Their household is quite a dour one. Her mother is a sort of beauty. She's a beautiful woman who gave up what could have been a sort of more interesting life to have children with this, with her very boring husband, who sort of keeps her, you know, again, get very few, very limited existence, really. And just these terrible things happen to the family. I mean, you know, one of their children dies. The mother then runs away with a lover. The father then goes off to be a sort of a missionary. And this poor girl sort of has to live through this. But it's not, I don't know, it's not sort of sentimental. It's very beautifully done. And actually it's very cleverly done in the way that you have the older, the narrator looking back on her younger life. And so you're able to sort of juxtapose things that she understands as an adult. Like as an adult, she understands how terrible her mother's life probably was for her. But as a child, she obviously just realized that something terrible was going on in her home, but she couldn't work out what it was. And I think it took me completely by surprise because it has echoes of it has sort of Dickensian echoes to it. It made me think of things, you know, like the Bronte sisters, even a little bit of The Secret Garden, these sorts of stories. But it seemed very fresh and new and sort of urgent the way it was written. And yeah, that really took me by surprise. And I would definitely be more interested in looking at, I'd be interested to see what else Dorothy Evelyn Smith had written, but I don't think she certainly wasn't one of the more prolific writers included here.
Okay, that's brilliant. That's one that we've all got to go away and we haven't read it. We can be pretty sure that we haven't read it. Now we're all got to go away and read it.
Yeah. And I think one of the interesting things I think we probably should mention about this series is that maybe different to something like Persephone or the Virago Modern Classics, this is very much kind of putting these books into the context of their time. I think one of you mentioned, you know, in the blurb that talks about the marital act or, you know, different things. And these are very important. At the beginning of the books, there are sort of timelines of significant things that happened around the time this novel was written that might have seeped into its pages.
So we're all going to go and read Dorothy Evelyn Smith, is that right?
Yeah, that's the one. Oh, the Brave Music.
Brilliant. Let's do that. Thank you very much for joining us, Lucy.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Sanna Meyer and Lucy Scholes. You'll find the pieces we've discussed in this week's issue of the TLS in print, online and in the app edition. The website is a good place to start though, so go to the-tls.co.uk. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.